Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Want to know another Snapple fact? The first hot air balloon passengers were a sheep, a duck, and a rooster. Ridiculous. Check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavored Snapple near you.
It's got to be said.
What?
That you, above all others, can appreciate. You can appreciate.
Really
oh, come on. You can appreciate.
Paul to open.
Yes, and what do you do?
Because I know you're a fake and I'm for a fact, so I want to know why you're doing this.
You've been given a second chance.
Oh, I do that.
Oh, I have barely begun.
You get a prize, honey. Now, you two, if you don't mind.
Hey there, and welcome to Pull to Open, normally a random quest throughout the Doctor Who universe. But not this time. No, not random. But in the Doctor Who universe, in the Doctor Who canon, we are going to be doing something different this week. I'm Pete Paschal.
And I'm Chris Taylor. And yes, you may remember that we did here on Pull to Open some hot takes on the specials, on the 60th anniversary specials, as we collectively call the Star Beast, the Wild Blue Yonder, and the Giggle. And what we're going to do today is a bit more than a cold take or hot take or either of those. It's in between. It's the Goldilocks of takes. It's the lukewarm take.
It's just right.
Yes, we're not too far away from the specials that we're looking at them with a historical eye. We're not so close that we're kind of reacting with our immediate reactions. We've had some time for it to marinate, Pete, right? It's been a couple of months now.
Yeah,
when we're recording this, so all of that kind of initial enthusiasm has faded, but also sort of the initial like, oh, they didn't do it right because I had this immediate reaction because this, and I think a lot of people are kind of going through this process of like looking back on them as a whole, as almost a single story, which they do almost comprise. And thinking, well, what did we witness there? What did we like it?
Yeah.
So, exactly. You can go back and listen to our hot takes if you want that version. But yeah, this is a more considered version in the cool light of day, as it were. Pete, it's been a couple of months now. Do you feel like more well disposed towards the specials, or how's your general thinking on it gone?
Right. I mean, I do feel like they're almost one adventure in a sense, right? Like, I feel like even though they're three distinct stories, they're really united by this idea of the reuniting Tennant and Tate. More than that, just establishing what RTD 2.0 is going to look like. Now, right. We've also had the Church of Ruby Road since then, and we're probably not going to talk too much about that because that's really kind of a standalone. It's Shudi's first full episode as the Doctor. We've said a good chunk about that already in our hot take. And it really sort of stands apart to a large extent from the other three. Although I do think there's hints that I think there's arguably more hints about what season one of Shudi is going to look like in the three specials with David Tennant and Catherine Tate than that first episode, because you're kind of getting caught up in all the things like the goblins and Millie Gibson, because that's her real first episode. There's kind of like it's doing a lot of work, that one, whereas the previous three sort of gives RTD a little bit more of a through line and a chance to sort of settle in. So I think there's more to be mined there.
Yeah. When you think about what he had to achieve here, right, it was, he had to bring on board people who were into the show at sort of its audience height, the early 2010s, basically when he left it. And so he had to bring people back, people who'd sort of, you know, been disillusioned by the Capaldi era, the Whittaker era, or both. and you know, and say, hey, you know, it's fresh, it's new, it's, you know, so you had to reintroduce it in a way, right? But then also celebrate an anniversary, right? And a lot of us were expecting a lot more on the celebration side other than Tennant and Tate.
Yeah, I think to your point, you know, we should sort of draw a distinction a little bit between the mass appeal of Doctor Who and the hardcore fans or even casual fans. Because here's the thing. You're right. It's like he comes back and it's a reboot. It's like, hey, it's new, it's different, but much different reboot because it's also the actor that you really like is coming back. So it's a... Is it, what's the right word here? It's not prequel. It's not quite full reboot. It's not a retread, because that's a slam.
It's a preboot.
I guess it's a preboot, right? Exactly. That's good. I like that. Yeah. I wouldn't say it's like threading a needle, but it is like, it has this extra element of like, particularly David Tennant and Catherine Tate too, of course, but Tennant was like the person who was the Doctor when it really ascended to a worldwide phenomenon. Eccleston kicked it off, and you know, we wouldn't have had Tennant if that wasn't such a great season. But with Tennant 1.0, it really became this crazy worldwide phenomenon that and Smith sort of ably with Moffat grabbed the ball and ran and made it even more of a phenomenon here in America.
Matt Smith definitely stood on David Tennant's shoulders in the US.
What I want to sort of loop that back around to is kind of a question, which is, is this what we expected? And let me clarify what I mean by we. Now, I don't mean we, you and me, even though we were the people doing this, but is it what the world expected from getting the band back together, as it were?
Yeah, and was it kind of, you know, as an anniversary special, how does it compare to the 50th anniversary special? Is, I think, right, another good kind of benchmark to measure it against. And I think that the first thing I'd say about that is I think RTD was right to not even try.
Yeah.
Like the Day of the Doctor was such a multi-doctor spectacular, you know, changing whole things about the entire canon of Doctor Who, introducing the War Doctor. And really, you've got to say that the 50th was kind of almost a three special anniversary as well, right? You know, the name of the Doctor, Day of the Doctor, Time of the Doctor kind of go together as a trio, like these three. So this is RTD saying, I'm not even going to play that game. You know, we were expecting multi-doctors. We got them, not in a way that we were expecting. And I think it was wise to, like, if Matt Smith had shown up at some point, or if they'd had, as RTD said, we mentioned this in the hot take, he said that he'd considered, and that the ship that the Wild Blue Yonder sat on, inserting a cryogenically frozen William Hartnell, just to kind of give us a
mess with us, really.
Mess with us, exactly. A multi-doctor messing with us. I'm glad he didn't do that. I'm glad. I got to say, overall, I think he took the right approach. I think it was a moment where he didn't want to be compared to Moffat, and he went off in an opposite direction. And you really can't, you know, like, don't even try to do the Day of the Doctor again. You know, do something different. This moment was something different.
I'd also throw in, we just had a multi-doctor story in The Power of the Doctor.
Exactly.
I mean, to my knowledge, Chibnall and RTD did not collaborate in the sense that I don't think Chibnall cleared it with him. Hey, by the way, I'm going to do a bunch of multi-doctor stuff, FYI, for your 60th. Or maybe it might have been that, but that would have been the extent of it.
Yeah. So, I mean, they talk all the time. They know what each is going on.
But yeah, exactly. When I've also said, you can only, you know, smash that multi-doctor button so many times before it just starts to get worn out and we're just kind of going to start shrugging. Okay, come on. Mm-hmm. So I think it was, he had to sort of challenge himself not to do that. Although I got to say, I'm just going to get it out here. It's about time you came back, Matt.
Like, I know.
Let's start figuring that out in the next, you know, 4 or 5 years or so. You know, you're doing good stuff and we love you and all that. And at least to start doing some big finishes or something. So anyway.
Yeah. Once you're done with all that Game of Thrones stuff, come on back to the franchise that still loves you. Yeah. I think you're right. Well, okay. So there's that question. And then there's also the question of like, how do you bring the fans back for more than just the specials, right? How do you show them there's something new here, and how do you impress upon the world at large that Doctor Who is still a creative force, that it's not spent, you know, this is something we're on the lookout throughout our random journey, is the moments that Doctor Who got a bit tired and would retread itself or reintroduce the Daleks and you know, just lean on old tropes. And you gotta say that these specials, the one word that keeps coming to mind about them for me is fresh. They felt fresh. They felt new. They did not feel like a lumbering old franchise that is like too respectful of its own history. You know, they go off in fresh and new and interesting directions. They're not afraid to try new things and suggest new things about the Doctor, and, you know, and introduce new things like bi-generation, which we should probably have mentioned before this podcast goes too far, as the most controversial thing to have emerged from the specials.
Well, I think bi-generation is a good example of the word I would use, which is deliberate. And I picked that word specifically because I think it's in contrast to the Chibnall era, which we, I think, mistook for deliberate, but was really just loosey-goosey,
back of an
whatever. And I'll be, you know, like, I've got my issues with the Chibnall era, but one of them is that because it isn't deliberate, it just kind of feels a bit clumsy at times, I have to say, you know, particularly with some of those one-off episodes, not even the arc ones, where, you know, Orphan 55 comes to mind, and it's easy to kick that episode down, and I'm not going to get into it again here. You could go back to our podcast that talks about that episode in detail, but just an episode that really just doesn't even understand the show, like the structure of the show and what future history is and possibilities in time. So again, RTD, I think, reassured us that he still has that deliberateness, and it comes out sometimes as meticulousness and perfectionism and lines that are very, I think, architected to intrigue, even if they won't necessarily be paid off. A good example being the toy maker making a jigsaw of the Doctor's history. Mm-hmm. Obviously very deliberate. Put in, it's a split second, blink and you miss it line, but RTD did, he knew that was going to tantalize fans and, you know, for some of us, sort of let us give ourselves permission to start to enjoy this era on a different level. And I think that's very smart.
I gotta say, if I would make one change, it would be to just insert a little bit more about that. Having the Doctor say what you mean, and the toy maker just reel off a few things like they actually do in Curse of Fenric, where we've recently been to. There's at least some mention of all of these things that Fenric is supposedly responsible for in the Doctor and Ace's history. So just a little bit more would have pleased me, and I think pleased some of the older fans would be like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
So just to sort of expand a little bit on the deliberateness, by the way, I agree with you. I think not necessarily literally naming things, but having a little more than just Tennant giving him a weird look at that moment would have been okay. Again, it's a delicate balance because you don't want it to be distracting within the story that they're telling. So flipping the deliberateness thing a bit, where I think this, I'm a little skeptical of this, and I want to be careful with my words here because I don't want to come across as what I think a lot of people think is a sort of I wouldn't say toxic, but I would say predictable part of fans are like, oh, it's all woke and he's showing he's woke or whatever. Like, I don't want to go down that road. Maybe we do that. That's a future podcast. Again, I think we got to sort of attack that a little more carefully. But I do think some of the sort of quote unquote deliberate choices where he is trying to, I'm not sure if it's advancing a deliberately sort of progressive point or trying to correct or update his own approach to the show, which I think sometimes more progressive fans guilt him over, and case in point, end of the world and blah, 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 environmental messaging, which I don't know if he's ever going to do that. But here's the point. I'm going to point at like something I gave him a hard time for in The Giggle, where he sort of had a lot of, not a lot of, it's actually not that many if you look at it, but they're very, they stink at like a sore thumb, are those moments where they point out like Shirley's disability and sort of kind of keep referencing it and keep coming around to it. And it gets to the point where you're like, okay, I get what you're doing. And again, he's being very deliberate about it, but I do think he gets in his own way there in terms of storytelling. Yes. Like I say, I think the better choice for a lot of these things he's trying to do is simply have it out there and tell the story that you're going to tell, but have that thing be there, you know? And I think he actually was, I think, better about this in 1.0 in some ways, where you had a character like, for example, Jack Harkness, who was just very clearly sort of this omnisexual being, sort of pushing those norms without always talking about it on a meta level, even though they were there. I'm saying they obviously didn't dwell on it, but it was like, you know what I mean? Like, I think there was a meta level now to it where you see it coming and it's a bit more clumsy.
I do know what you mean, and I do have to, probably not surprised to know that I disagree with you on that front. I actually really liked the way that, for want of a better word, RTD handled the wokeness here. As opposed to the Chibnall era, where I felt that it was very heavy-handed, and we talked about, even great episodes like Rosa, sort of spoiled by a bit of an after-school specialish feel, right? Not necessarily destroys the whole episode, and yeah, that's a particularly strong example of like where it's not too foregrounded. But I did feel like it got in the way of the story in the Chibnall here, and I didn't have that reaction with RTD. I thought that he inserted it nicely into the story. But to the point of like this being the main point of debate, like this is the Last Jedi moment for Doctor Who, basically. Because if you look at Rotten Tomatoes, what you've got based on 57 critical reviews is 96%. Excellent score. Okay. Excellent score. And individually, I think it's something like 93, 100, 100 for the three specials. Now, the audience score is 43%. And I bet you can't tell what's been going on in the audience score. I bet you can't tell that there's been a lot of review bombing and a number of review. Like, it's all 5-star reviews and 1-star reviews. Right.
Yeah, I mean,
you could probably write the 1-star reviews yourself, and a lot of them are sort of telling on themselves, where they say, "I joined Rotten Tomatoes just to say that Disney has ruined Doctor Who."
Right, and I'm here's the thing. Like, I think there's a whole separate podcast we probably need to do on this phenomenon, and I don't know if we're going to solve it. And it might be a mistake that even stepping into this, but you're not wrong, but you also are, right? Like, in the sense that, like, if yes, that proves both your point and the opposite point, if you know what I'm saying, which is that the people giving those 1-star reviews will point to that 96% and see that as like evidence of a sort of progressive ideology that has done sort of an institutional capture of things. And, you know, it's like, yes, there's a big disparity, but is there, it's the same sort of argument of like, well, 70 million people voted for Trump and whatever, right? Or 70 plus million. It's kind of like, how can you possibly invalidate all that much of the population, right? So it is like, I think the points they often make are clumsy. I do think there's a lot of toxicity in there, but I also think there must be a there, or it simply wouldn't be there. You know, like, there must be.
No smoke without fire, you're saying?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it may be summarized in a review here from Darren H., who says, weak 1-star review, weak storylines with undertones of partially hidden and open offensiveness to majority groups. Yeah, majority groups are offended by this. Yeah, forget the minorities. Be nicer to majority groups. Now, I'm not entirely clear what that's about. Like, it does seem to be a lot of these people are telling on themselves that they basically just don't like the modern world. The modern world is very diverse, and we pay attention to a lot of minority groups. And
I think you can be pro diversity without wanting to have it like pointed out constantly that diversity is awesome every time you turn around, right? Like, in other words, I think there's a middle ground here, which is often overlooked. Of look, yes, like no one's against the diversity or whatever this thing is, but I also like making it constantly about that isn't good entertainment either. You know, like so it's like how do you thread the needle? How do you make the good entertainment while also making sure you're making the points you want to make? I don't know. I will say RTD is probably better at it than Chibnall, certainly, and probably a lot of other people. So given the choice, I would rather have him do it, not necessarily than just Chibnall, or rather than not making the point. I don't know what I'm trying to say. I'm just trying to say that I think he can be clumsy at it, but I do think he is judged too harshly for it, if I'm trying to make a thing, by particularly this group, which I do agree with you, is digging their feet in on a certain political point of view of the world and is not letting themselves see the all of the good stuff that is actually coming through as well. Like, yes, there's some clumsy stuff, but it doesn't ruin it. I guess that's the point I'm trying to make.
Yeah. And a lot of these reviews are, you know, deliberately misgendering Rose. And like, you know, it's clear what the agenda is here, right?
Let me
be a guardian of the edge here and pull us back from the edge of the political discussion and the diversity discussion. And pull us back to, I think, a bigger problem with the storytelling, which is that RTD still has an issue. Like, he is a great storyteller, but he always has an issue with that big old reset button. He does love to push it at the end of an episode, and I still think that the weakest moments of the specials were in the Starbeast, where the destruction of London gets reversed. You know, there's those giant cracks in the streets of London that just somehow gets wiped out. And then the whole kind of resolution of the meta crisis, and this may be the one, you know, point where I agree with the anti-wokeness brigade, is that like just having a whole thing of like, just let it go is not necessarily a good way to wrap it up. And it is just hitting the reset button on this whole meta crisis thing that we were all kind of, you know, really invested in.
Yeah. And it's also sort of confirmation, I think, where fan consensus has fallen with regard to ranking these, which is that Wild Blue Yonder and The Giggle are pretty close. And some people prefer, I don't think that many, but I think most prefer Wild Blue Yonder, but some people prefer The Giggle. And I think mainly because of Neil Patrick Harris and sort of seeing that sort of epic showdown again with Tennant. But everyone seems to put The Starbeast dead last, which is too bad, because that's the first one that sort of kicked off this era. But I don't know if it was the most important one to get right. So I don't know. I guess I'd ask you, do you like that the way the consensus has gone, and that it's kind of gone Wild Blue Yonder, Giggle, and then Starbeast? And is that good for the show?
Yes, I think it actually is good for the show. No, so here's the thing. Starbeast, like you have to, there's a certain almost Christmas episode-ness to it, which is that the living room's going to be louder than usual, right? It's new Doctor Who. It's returning and it's trying to bring in a mass audience. So it's doing something different. You know, RTD said specifically he was trying to go for a Pixar kind of vibe with that one, and I think he achieved it for the most part. And I kind of love that it's like so focused on the Meep. That was great to bring the Meep back and sort of, you know, bring in the old school fans that way, because we all love a bit of Meep. We all love a bit of Dave Gibbons, Tom Baker, Doctor Who comics, right? So, you know, we did a whole episode on reviewing the original comic book version. So I think that you sort of needed a bit of throat clearing in that sense, not to say that that's all the Starbeast was, but you sort of need to, you know, and also remind us that this is a show for kids first and foremost. Like, get the kids first, do the Pixar style thing for the kids first, and then like we're all on board then. And we're ready to go to wherever the TARDIS is going to take us, because Donna dropped coffee on the console, you know? So yeah, I think it's actually pretty good that they got better as they went along. Now, I'm not sure if Wild Blue Yonder is better than The Giggle. I think it probably is. It's got the battle episode thing. But yeah, in general, the idea of the first not being the best, you know, I think it was good enough, and it had to do something different. So
Wait a minute. You don't necessarily think Wild Blue Yonder is better than The Giggle? This is good, because this is actually showing like a little bit maybe of difference. Because like, to me, Wild Blue Yonder is above the rest, like head and shoulders above the rest. Yes, it's probably advantaged a bit by the by the bottle episode. Yeah. But The Giggles, I wouldn't say it's necessarily a close second, but it's second. And then Starbeast is way down. So, but you seem to be putting The Giggle maybe at the same or even higher than Wild Blue Yonder.
I would say in terms of how much it affected me and how much I think about it and how many risks it took, I think The Giggle is superior. Now, would I rate it above Wild Blue Yonder just on a story level? Probably not. But, you know, it's they're trying to do different things.
Yeah.
You know, I think that The Giggle had its sort of requisite level of WTF. Which is kind of what it was aiming for. And the Wild Blue Yonder had its requisite level of, like, we're just going to chill out and have a creepy adventure on a spaceship, and we're going back to basics here. Right? So they were aiming for different things. It's kind of really hard to measure them off against each other because of that. And I think they both succeeded in what they were trying to do. But yeah, the Giggle, you know, we were expecting something just mad, to use RTD's favorite word. And I think we got it. Like, we were kind of really hyped up for it. And I think we got something crazy. Like, yes, I think that I would love just a little bit more explanation about the Jigsaw of the history. I would also love just a little bit more explanation of bi-generation it's supposed to be a myth. Like, just a little tweak more than that, and I'd be fine with it.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Well, also, I think, and I don't think this would spoil much, like a little bit more of what happens now. Mm. And there's been a lot of discussion, most of it unofficial, about the 14th Doctor eventually having a true regeneration into the 15th. And there's all the sort of off-screen stuff RTD said about every Doctor now being sort of bifurcated, which I don't even know what that means, you know? And the thing is, why I don't think it would spoil much if they put more there is that the two Doctors sort of go off and live their lives and aren't wondering these things, right? So in other words, they seem to sort of already know what's going to happen, in at least on some level, but they haven't clued us in.
Yeah.
So, yeah, again, I know off screen they've said there's no plans to bring Tennant back. Maybe that's a mislead. Maybe it's not. Still, I feel like this is one of those things, kind of like the Timeless Child, that is changing lore so much that you're going to have to come back around to it at some point just to give the validity to what they did in The Giggle.
You know, one question that's just occurred to me is that, like, when Shooty creates two TARDISes out of one with the magic hammer, does that mean, I mean, you can't just create or destroy a matter, even with a magic hammer. So is the TARDIS now half its original size? Is it half as big on the inside?
Yeah, well, it's also like maybe, like, in other words, like we've had a bi-generation, a bifurcation, if you will. Will we have a reunification later? So presumably, maybe the TARDIS recombines with itself if there's a real regeneration. If you know, I don't know. Like, again, he's obviously making up the rules as he goes along.
I would actually prefer it. You know what? If there isn't an official regeneration of the 14th, if the bi-generation was it,
Yeah.
And then, because that means at some point in the dim and distant future, maybe when Tennant's a very old actor, we could actually see a Doctor die for the first time, like not regenerate. Mm. And
interesting.
Yeah, you could have That'd something right. to say. You know, and that could sort of be a great lead in to an episode, a great cold open. Like the death of the death of Doctor 14.
The death of Doctor Who.
Yes. To use a Sarah Jane title, right?
I thought it was a title of one of the episodes of The Chase.
Oh, yes, The Chase, yes. The death of Doctor Who. I think there's something, there's the, like the Doctor's funeral in the Sarah Jane Adventures, right, where she meets Matt Smith. Yeah, so wow, that would be fantastic down the line. I'd love that, and what an ominous cold open that would make.
Yeah, that would be pretty awesome.
Maybe that could even be the 70th special. Like all of the doctors are gathered together for the funeral of the 14th.
Oh man, look at this, RTD call us. So, taking it all as a whole, what predictions do you have for season one of Shooty? And it doesn't have to be like plot stuff. I'm not talking about plot stuff. It's just like, do you have a sense that basically RTD is taking this in a place that, you know, we're going to like? Is it like, I mean, obviously we're going to like it on some level, but is it, what we have to go on are these specials and RTD 1.0. And of course the stuff he says, you know, off screen.
It's definitely not RTD 1.0. I think that's the first thing we're seeing. But also I think we're seeing that he has perhaps gained a better ability to steer the ship and certainly to steer the Disney money. Because, of course, this isn't Disney ruining Doctor Who. And if you believe it's ruined, it's RTD himself. He's just, you know, it's the classic thing with Disney. They, you know, as the author Timothy Zahn said about Disney's relationship with Lucasfilm, they bring a dump truck of money on Monday and they return on Friday with two dump trucks. You know, that's how it goes. They don't interview with the story people. They might have a few notes, but you know, RTD is a senior enough figure. Like he's in charge, he's larger in charge, and I think he proves it here. And he is threading the needle that every Doctor Who showrunner has to thread, that Chibnall also tried to thread, of like big time fans, new fans, right? You try and get them both. And how Chibnall was trying to do it was, I think, how they kind of tried to do it in the classic show as well, right? And we've talked about this in the McCoy era, you know, but the rot started earlier than that, where they basically had, you know, fans saying, oh, like, you know, Ark of Infinity, for example, throw in Omega. Yeah, everyone will remember Omega. No, they won't. Like, everyone will remember this reference to this, you know, JNT saying we can't have vampires in Curse of Fenric because they were in State of Decay 7 years earlier, crying out loud. You know, even more. But yeah, so there's that. That is the bad way, I think, to keep classic fans on board. We're going to throw out an obscure reference, this thing that three people will get. Whereas RTD is much more in the sense of like, no, I'm keeping everyone on board, including, by the way, the Chibnall era fans, you know, throwing in the, you know, saying yes and to the Timeless Children, making the Doctor very explicitly an orphan. Obviously, that's going to come back again. So, yeah, I think it's a good sign. He knows what to do with the Disney money. He knows how to unite the fandom somewhat. He's also just like not afraid to do whatever he thinks is necessary for a good story. And that's the key, is that he clearly knows that story is king, and you're not going to have a show if you don't bring in the millions of casual viewers and look after them first.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I definitely think 1.0, even though I wouldn't say it's completely devoid of sort of clues what we would sort of see in this new era, I do think it's not much of a guide. Well, partly because, you know, think about this. The first time he brought back the show, like, everything was fresh. Like, he did fresh looks on the Daleks and fresh looks on the Cybermen and like, all these villains and these concepts, the Time War, and even just the special effects around regeneration energy. What is regeneration anyway? And blah, 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 and The Last of the Time Lords. And there was, like, surprisingly a lot of canvas he found, even though it was a show with a long, long history. There was a lot. The way he set up the canvas was very blank, sort of gave himself a lot of blank space. And I feel like there's this canvas, it's kind of simultaneously smaller and bigger because so much of that's been done.
Bigger on the inside, you might say.
But also, like, now he has, like you said, the Disney money. So there's more potential to, in those areas of canvas that may not be as big as they were in 2005, but holy cow, can you get granular with some of these brushstrokes? So I feel like that's what he's doing. And he still has that sort of deliberateness. But I think what we're in for is maybe somewhat, I'm hesitant to say smaller because I don't think they're going to feel smaller, but it is going to be more filling in his own world and Shooty's world and really sort of getting interesting about those whatever sort of strands he sort of pulls in from the first. Like you mentioned Mavic Chen and stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
Like I feel like there's going to be, even though that's a very minor thing from...
Yeah, that's a bit Chernobyl-esque. Like, yeah, we're going to throw in a mention of Mavic Chen and all of the destruction of Legopolis. Yes.
So, yeah, I think we're in for something interesting and some very character-driven episodes that, he's so good at that domestic stuff, particularly with sort of Millie Gibson and her character, Ruby Sunday's family.
He loves families. That much is still clear. I'll also bring it back around to the very first thing that happens in the Star Beast as an example of the fact that he still likes to play with form. Because how does the Star Beast open? Once upon a time, Lord. Mm. And it is the Doctor and Donna both talking to camera as they would in the theater. Now, we barely got to discuss this in amongst everything else in the hot take, but like that's the first time that's happened in Doctor Who, right? That is, he comes right out of the gate in these specials with a new way of talking to the audience that the show has never tried before. And maybe you don't think it worked, but I kind of loved it. Mm. I was like, oh, this is weird. Like the characters are doing recaps. And normally that has potential to really not work in a major way, right?
I'd argue maybe it didn't even work in this case.
All right. Well, then we disagree about something else about the Star Beast.
About what my initial take was on that, I'd have to go back and listen. But until you just described it just now, I'd completely dragged and dropped that out of my memory of the Star Beast.
Again, it's sort of like I feel like it's a theater trick, right? I noticed this at the time. I think that it sort of, you can kind of imagine them on stage in different spotlights, and the spotlight goes from one to the other, right? So in a way, it's sort of like you're doing a thing that's the opposite of having Disney money. You're doing a thing that could be done in the classic show, just like have a spotlight on one character and they tell their story direct to camera, like breaking the fourth wall. So big risk, big reward, as far as I'm concerned. Like that sort of punctures the noise. It catches everyone up. It's better than a previously on Doctor Who, which is, which is hard to do. Moffat did it
500
once.
500 years later on Doctor
twice,
Who. Yeah.
Yeah, for Twice Upon a Time, he did that, 500 episodes later, or whatever it was, or 500 episodes previously. Just zero in on the thing that we need to know and reassure the audience that you don't need to go back and watch the entire Jodie era. If you remember how Donna left the Doctor, like that's enough. So that was a sign, I think, that he's playing around with the format. He's not treating the show like in any sort of religious sense, which is good. You do not like that. That would be a death knell for Doctor Who if you're being too careful about it and trying too much to follow what's gone before. No, this is a new show. It's got to be fresh. It's got to be constantly reinvented, and RTD gets it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. I will say, I think Wild Blue Yonder, even though it's my favorite of the three, I don't think is going to be representative of like what we're getting soon, because it is such a bottle episode and it's so clearly written for that pair.
Yes.
I think conceptually we're going to get some interesting stuff. Again, this is, I think Wild Blue Yonder shows Davies doesn't just get obviously Doctor Who and his leads, but he gets the potential of it, and he's had this since the beginning. I remember I made comparisons from that episode to episodes like End of the World, and just cranking up the stakes and the sci-fi elements to such a large degree that it just really pulls you in. He's the master of that. He gets sci-fi. So I'm very sort of reassured by that episode that he hasn't forgotten, even though he's done a lot of other non-sci-fi stuff since.
He gets sci-fi. He knows how to make you care about characters. That is, you know, job number one of any good writer. And it's surprising how many writers forget it. RTD doesn't. But also, Wild Blue Yonder, for being a bottle episode, may end up having the longest term impact through the whole Mavity thing. Because didn't we get a Mavity reference in The Church on Ruby Road?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a running joke throughout his era. I think until the next showrunner corrects that, if they want to. It's just going to be part of Doctor Who from now on, which is it's okay. It's like when everyone said frack in Battlestar Galactica. It's going to be like that.
I love it. Yeah, it would be great if that ends up being a thing that's only resolved in RTD's final episode of, you know, whenever he decides to leave the show again. Or if it just keeps going and it's, you know, this thing that carries on all the way through to the 70th anniversary. Mavity, just because the Doctor is the one who used the word in Church on Ruby Road, so it's not like the Doctor is aware that there's something wrong.
So one thing I'm just going to add before we wrap up is that I recently heard about a thing they cut from the credit sequence, so the new opening credit sequence that they did, which, you know, cost tons of money and, you know, has the TARDIS streaking across cosmic clouds and whatever else during the theme song. They had a bit where Tennant and Tate would sort of lean out of the TARDIS and actually shot it like really quickly, so you'd see them in the TARDIS. And then they actually shot a similar bit with Shuri Gatwa and Gibson, and they basically RTD was the only person who liked it. For all the audience he screened it with, for all the people he showed it to, everyone said, yeah, you got to cut that bit out. It looks just stupid. And I think the biggest thing, the person that had the effect was Moffat. Moffat was just like, he saw it. He's like, I love your new title sequence, but you got to cut that bit out. And so it's gone. So now it's clean. It doesn't have, you don't see anybody in it.
And that's Stephen Moffat saying that. Stephen Moffat, the guy who put Capaldi's eyebrows in the opening credits.
Well, but I think this shows, you know, he can still take criticism and like the, and feedback, right? And if it does really make it better, or at least not subject people to something really, really naff looking, I guess, he can adjust. So he's got a little humility still. So that's a good, I think that portends well for the future.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think that's that opening sequence in general, I got to say, it rapidly became my favorite of all time. I know you're not supposed to say that.
Even more than the time tunnel?
Even more than the time tunnel.
Yeah,
there's something about, like, it's the all of the, you see the money on the screen. And I can't help it, even though I know it's dumb and it's like overused and it's a trope. The moment where the camera like zooms in, where it's like, wait, what's that? A TARDIS? A police box? Whoa, let's zoom in on that. I kind of like it. I can't help myself. Cool. I love it.
Alrighty. Well, that's our lukewarm take, I think. I don't know. Any final thoughts?
Oh, just that, you know, Doctor Who's back, baby. It's got Disney money and a fan who knows how to write stories, knows that stories come first. So I think that the long-term health of Doctor Who is perfectly assured, and this show will never get cancelled.
Exactly. I think Doctor Who needs a little bit more deliberateness now, and he's just the guy to do it.
Yes. Welcome back, RTD. We hope you're sticking around for a long time.
All right, folks. Go ahead. Tell us we're wrong. Tell us we're right. Tell us whatever you want. Just tell it to us on the socials. We're at Pull to Open on TikTok, Blue Sky, and we're at Pull to Open 63 on Instagram, Twitter, all the other places you can normally find us. And of course, we're on youtube.com/pulltoopen. Go check us out there. You can see us, and you can also become a true companion of the podcast by supporting us at the low, low price of $7.99. And plus, you'll get the podcast a day early. How about that?
Woohoo! All right. Well, we will see you day early, folks, a day early when we get back on our random adventure next week.